right. You're on again, Olaf.
Okay.
I'm going to take notes, so I'll be
quiet. All right. I can do that, I think. So I guess I should take responsibility when I sent in a suggestion to hold this theme group. My interests are in land cover land use way back, and I came into it from an information semantics angle about 10 years ago when I did my PhD work. So about 8 years ago, I started working at Penn State on the project was really about moving and communicating scientific information between researchers. So we could communicate, we found this over in Pennsylvania, you found this over in Arizona. This is what climate change looked to us locally. How do we compare that? And part of that became my focus in land cover and realizing that land cover has been constantly trying to put out these, here's the final land cover taxonomy, this is what we're going to use from now on. And, you know, the National Land Cover Database from 1992 firmed up and followed up in 2001. But we had to do some slight changes there because we weren't too happy with the classes. And the result is that essentially when the 2001 data came out was, well, you can't really compare them. You can't do the overlay that everyone wanted to do and see, so what happened? No, don't do that. Partly because of resolution, the pixels wouldn't match up. You would have to do like a 9x9 area, do some kind of averaging over that to be more confident, but also mainly because of the class definition change. So instead of focusing on how do we find the fixed standard, which seems to be kind of seen from this morning, we'll never reach that one ontology for anything, but we will have to live with the constantly changing, locally relevant, but globally not so relevant conceptualizations of the world. How do we live with that and harmonize that in some way? And the interesting thing is that when I looked into this, I started looking at cognitive theories and one of the things that kind of bubbled up in that community was looking at categories made up of a lot of different small pieces. Similar to what people have said here, kind of not saying from the top down that we have things like, from a land cover perspective, we would start out and say, these are land features, these are water features, and then we'd divide the land features into other things. But down towards the end, we end up having categories that are so similar, but they divide it up here. So we have these forested wetlands, and then we have mangrove estuaries, and they're part of the big separation up here, but still they're so close in the way they look. They shouldn't be bad. If you do a graph measure of how similar they are, they're totally different. But really, they're almost the same thing. So it made more sense to look at these ideas from the bottom up and say, what are all the bits and pieces that all these categories are made up of? And make sure to include that in the definition in a formal way so we can compute with it. Right. So I looked into this one of the main ideas about how we can how cognitive scientists believe we think in terms of the adding up features essentially. I looked mainly at two big different ways of doing this. One is through a list of features. It has this is vegetation cover, this is water cover, this has this feature, this is that feature, and so forth. But that, again, just moves this category problem one step down. Because all of a sudden, say, it's vegetation cover. What does that mean? Is there a limit to it? Or you can say that, well, it has to have 60% or more. And if some other feature set, it's got to have 50% or more, and you have two different features that don't compare well. The other approach, if I'm getting around that, is to think of it as dimension, as essentially scaled dimension. So if you follow the analogy that Christoph talked about, the remote sensing pattern measured data. So in a remote sensing perspective, you could have a couple of different spectral bands, and each place would then have a response signature in each of those bands. Now you can think of the vegetation classes as having these dimensions of features. You can think of each vegetation class will have a certain amount of vegetation coverage. Okay? It will have, you would be able to say how what is the coverage in terms of trees? Is there any water coverage? Is there a seasonality to this particular vegetation coverage? All of those would be different types of attributes. Characteristics that essentially when you define this as discrimination. So if you treat them as a scale, and the best example is again vegetation cover. If you are happy with forests having 60% or more coverage, you can set that interval. Define that and have this interval. It's characteristic of this particular land cover type. And then you go to the next feature and talk about the water seasonality. And you can have this, like Christoph mentioned, you can have, you know, a yearly cycle. And you could say that, well, in June, there's, from June to August, there is generally water covered because of flooding, you know. So you could have these attributes with these intervals. And then you can take each land cover separately and just put them side by side and look at them feature by feature and see.
I don't know why your line is lit up. I'm plugged in the line too.
Hello, Nancy, we can hear you.
I'm sorry.
Hello, hi. Nancy.
And interesting thing was that at the time I was working with this, the FAO started promoting this land cover classification system that essentially worked along the same thinking, defining land cover classes through this collection of attributes rather than beginning from the top and then splitting off. The problem that is still in that system, I think, is that it still does these the crisp, you know, categorical features in their description without having a way to resolve ambiguities that appear when you don't use the same descriptors, okay? So, sort of my main idea behind land cover classification in any categorization, I think, is I don't think that ontologies like OWL or the typical ontology you would find described in OWL, where you have, you know, this has a part this or this is a type of this, is I firmly believe that's the wrong thing to do. Because what I looked at with these feature dimensions, you can actually infer those relations instead based on those basic characteristics. If I have all the characteristics that you have, and then some, it's more of a class-subclass relationship inferred from those characteristics rather than saying it from the get-go. This is a subclass of that. So I kind of turn it around and say, well, wouldn't it be better if we just focused on putting out, for whatever domain we're trying to describe, trying to agree on one of the descriptive features that we use to describe vegetation. And that is a little bit easier. What are the things we talk about? Well, it is things like tree cover and soil fertility and climate patterns and things like that. Those are typically fairly measurable things. And once you have that list of things, people can start describing whatever they want to describe, and they can call it whatever they want as long as they stick to those parameters.
Yeah, and I would add that what Christoph showed was sort of an empirical way of finding the grouping. Clustering or clumping, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you could think of deriving these definitions from empirical data, given that you have enough empirical data on it, right, or proxies for them. You can essentially say that, hey, I look at this, this, and this, and I think these are the same things. Don't have to bother about what I call them, but I want to, again, the remote sensing analogy, these are my training areas for this class, right? What are the common characteristics? And then layer on everything you know in terms of parameters that physically and in terms of human intervention parameters that make up these places.
Like natural versus human.
Sure.
Where are we at? I'm not sure I know anybody.
Sorry.
I'm Gary Burke for it.
I'm James Wilson.
I'm from Maryland.
Hey, great. Glad you're here. I know you have things to add, too.
I'm Dave Marsters. I work with Bruce Allen. I'm currently supporting the MSCSI and a metadata harmonizing assets between NGA and D6GS.
Great.
I help with Woody.
Oh, okay, great.
I'm Greg Joyner. I work for the Genius Technology.
Okay. That makes the game. Great, I'm sorry for the interruption, but I want to make sure that
there's anybody online.
Well, yes, is there any? Well, speak in there.
Oh, is there any online?
What should our speaker do?
Nancy, I'm here in Madison.
Can you hear us okay, Nancy?
I hear you fine, and you can hear me, so this is, I don't know why.
Well, you're clear as a bell. You're clearer than us.
Well, I'm on a different phone in a different room, so.
We're all learning.
Yeah.
Okay, Natalia is here, too. Okay, so I'm sorry to...
That's essentially where I come from, and what I've tried... When I started out presenting these ideas back in 2004, my colleagues at Penn State kind of looked at me and said, well, yeah, good luck. We're doing ontologies. This is not it. Because I was essentially saying, forget about ontologies and disaggregate everything you have and just throw them into the bin and use these parameters to match them up again.
So, you know, I think what you're talking about is that before you have an ontology, you have to have ontological analysis. You're talking about ontological analysis, not trying to think about, oh, it's going to be an owl, and I'm going to represent it. You're saying, you know, what are the basic concepts that are going to make up this thing, this model that we're going to formalize as an ontology? That was very quickly covered by Christoph in one of the slides, but I think it's absolutely essential for really moving forward. So think of it as, you know, good analysis puts something good into this inferior representation that we can all use better.
Okay, that's right. I mean, that's why I wanted to come to this meeting, because I wouldn't have thought about it like that. I'm not an ontology guy, believe it or not. I'm really a vegetation guy.
I don't really see where the problem is. What you're talking about sounds to me like domains and ranges. Like you could have, you know, a range of, you know, chlorophyll levels, or a range of something, of impervious surface. And the, what's left is just the logical excimization of the different elements.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, unless owl is limited in its excimation, they aren't a match.
Right. I haven't tried it, but I think you can express what I'm saying in owl. But what I want to steer clear from is to also express in owl that this is a subclass of that. Right?
Yeah.
clip those things.
Now, that's different than the traditional taxonomies of, say, wetlands, for example, which were very
Right? Yeah, essentially that's what I'm saying. We could have it as an organizing idea, but when we put this into a formal ontology, we could maybe put it as a supplementary information source. But if we want to reason with these things and match them up with other things, I would rather argue that the loose bits of information are the bits of information you should use. So you say, here's the constitution. It's made up of this, 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 and this. And then, boom, into the pond and say, where does it fall?
One of the good things about starting from the bottom up or a middle is that you know it's grounded in something, right? Because that's where you start. Grounded in something. If you start at an abstract level, you never know if you're going to touch ground. You may create some concepts which never get there, in the sense of having important instances which are represented in your data. So if you start at the bottom, you know you're at least grounded. Now the question becomes whether you've created enough abstractions to be able to be useful across a little bit more of a range. And that's where use cases come, because the use cases sort of tell us, sort of, I want to be able to have this thing, this data, used in this process and shared with that data for that purpose, and it comes out with that. So that's a sort of a use case description of some kind. And in the process of laying that out, you sort of have another reality. It's not only the reality of the data, it's the reality of your use.
Mm.
You know, what the endpoint is. And then you have to say, well, okay, do I need to add something to my models that I currently have for the data to be able to have that happen? And in the case of data being a very heterogeneous and so forth, there's various things we make. So there is some level of abstraction. The way that he talked about it, remember he talked about we're overloaded, we get the stream flowing down, you're overwhelmed with the data, and then you show a cone sort of coming down. The idea is to find that happy medium of things that are abstractions that sort of take that big some portion of the big thing and make it into a small thing that can leverage other cones and bring them together.
And that's work, and that's still a new area.
Right.
Fine.
But you did a little bit of this, some of these things, I think. And your RDF presentation, I think you had to consider some of these things.
Yes, yeah. Well, I think Greg said that knowledge in the conceptual literature, the theoretical literature, and even in Amit's talk, when he's talking about the perspective ontology that we die, but nobody's formalized this. There's a metadata of perspective. There's not even any metadata of empirical stuff for the semantic thing. I'm sure it exists.
Correct me though with the universal problem. That if you have an understand information by seeing where it's come from, who, where is it, the chain of references, someone's going the other direction saying, what is the state of being trusted to make one.
Well, ultimate meaning is based is comparing, real data against a context. That's what you should mean. Because this context or this data, this context means one thing, and this same data with a different something is a little different. So I think that's where you're trying to get in a particular domain is to be able to define and describe the lowest level object that you really care about.
Mm-hmm.
You may only care about cars, but so you don't need to worry about going down and finding out about metal or that. So the car would be your least common denominator. That's the name, like what you were talking about, the vegetation, where you're describing all these little bits and pieces, and when you're scraping them together into a pot, and then you're applying their context to it, that's when you're really going to get your meaning.
Mm-hmm.
Think of on some of these areas besides the micro theory idea is situations. That is to say, you start to define situations of interest. This person's a general idea, and it can be abstract situations, but then you define a particular sort of situational scenario that's of interest. And situations employ actors, they have objects, obviously, and they have activities that happen on these things over time. So you can sort of abstract a situation scenario of interest. It might combine different actors, different observers coming and so forth, and that's what unites things. It's sort of pieces of these things that we think of as separate ontologies, but they are unified by the situation of interest. By the way, before we go too far, I want to make sure Dr. Sloan has an opportunity to tell us a little bit about his work and interest, too. So,
Nancy, can you hear Dr. Sloan?
I don't know how far we can get this, but okay, I'm sorry. I'll make adjustments here a little bit.
I want to describe something that I came across this year as I taught one of the entrance graduate class. There was one student group who wants to do a remote sensing study of village pillars in Darfur, Sudan. And he told me that I'm going to get a ground land use map of Sudan generated in Africa by Europeans. I'm going to get a fire map from our own department on Dr. Chris Justice. And by matching these two, when I see there is a fire in the desert, I know it's a fire on the village and it's being pillaged by militia. I say, well, go ahead. Okay. And he went to look at things and he came back to me and say, okay, I found these things that there are fires on the sand. Fires on the sand. I say, oh, well, we know fires on the forest or grassland of Pakistan, there is not much of big things in Sudan, Darfur. How come you found fires on sand? What happens is obviously the surface of the local villages in Sudan looks extremely like sand. Some of these villages were burned and they looked like fire on sand. And what happened is he realized something. These land cover maps cannot be. That's a very valuable lesson for first year graduate students. So he had to scrap his own work and started with things that saying, okay, how unreliable are land cover maps? So back to the topic here is, if I provide a land cover or land use map of the world and show you, would you trust me? And why would you trust me?
Well, you got to look at other things.
You got to look at other things.
You know, how you capture the information, you know, the sensory that's used, and you might have used other resources to pull together. You know,
that's right. Right.
So that whole lineage of what you use.
But it's sort of like Todd Demo, only a little bit more slower.
Yeah. The way you compare what I do is what other people do, then there is kind of a barrier here between systems, each based on our own idea. And the question becomes, if you think there is something common, and what is that common thing, and what is the different thing that becomes a barrier? And given the sense that nobody is perfect, and far from perfect, actually. Now, what I do is my PhD work will say, okay, well, carry on the Maryland tradition of remote sensing. So in the 80s, when the Maryland people started to work on remote sensing of the environment, they came up with something that is never published, never written down, just a consensus on the thing. If we are going to work on some remote sensing study, and we are going to design some algorithms or whatever, if it works in one place in Maryland here, yeah, fine. You can get a publication about it, but that's worthless because it probably wouldn't work in another place. So, but what people went down all these years to probably kind of coincide with the GIS community when Dr. Guchard, early in his career, was saying heterogeneity was more important than homogeneity. Popular was saying. No, the heterogeneity was a kind of a bang for the remote sensing people because, well, it's just a little bit missed, everything looks different. And with another time, we have another different thing. So late in the 90s, when Mr. Fritz, who is now teaching at Columbia University, and Matt Hansen, who is now in North Dakota, but they came up with saying, okay, we need to borrow something from the machine learning community, from computer sci-fi. And they got something called decision tree, sci-fi, which means you can make binary decisions in every kind of feature, or, and we say, spectral responses. And you can see, oh, okay, in this sense, when you have the green band bigger than something, then that category goes to forest. That all of us kind of agreeing somewhat. So that was very, very nice to the geographers because now you can see exactly where the classes are breaking down. What's the dichotomy there? And I mean,
the problem is with our approach that it's true. Dichotomies don't exist out there.
That's true.
Always great.
That's
except for rare cases where you actually have a property order. Someone decided to cut down all the trees and have grass land or a parking lot, and then boom, it's a forest.
Exactly.
But even in those situations, that parking lot might not look like an ordinary parking lot. It was all gravel, and it's worth a break for a car.
Yeah.
And the forest might have been too sparse to be really called a forest.
Correct.
Trees
so,
have these intermediaries.
Right.
That are hard.
And those
dichotomies.
Yeah. So so that when in the early years of we using classification, the there was an algorithm called parallel type classifier. That was exactly the very brutal dichotomy, pushing into small boxes of spectra in the feature space. That didn't work well. Everyone knows that. But then the decision tree was in some sense different because it says, all right, I'm going to draw my knowledge based on what you show me, and I'm going to draw that based on the minimum entropy that you would derive from. That actually was better. That's what it this way better. But what Rooster Freeze was not happy enough was that it's okay. If this thing could work a little bit for the world, but what we haven't solved is what if our has errors. And apparently it was not very error resistant. That was around year 2000. And then Curtis Woodcock over at Boston University said something which coincides with the Maryland people. It says the generalization is key. Without general, so that was the start point of my research. All right, so what is... what is the thing behind all this? And what I later found out was the classifier in the past 30 years, be it neural networks, decision trees, or the newer support vector machines, I'm sure your colleague, Dersen, showed that in the Department of Law. So they all have a hidden assumption. They were developed by computer scientists. By geographers. What computer scientists do is that they have a given set of signals that is very often artificial and generated in a system, closed system, while what we have is an open system. We don't know everything about the world. So, generate the big O, we are not very sure about that. So what happens is, with a closed system, what you get is what represents the thing. But in an open system, what you get, what I know, what I use to generate my map so that I want to convince you to get my tenure and my publication, can be wrong. And that was what I found. I say, all right, so the key here is classifying is what we choose to believe in might not be representative of the bigger. And there is a mathematical solution to that, and how to solve this problem. So that's what my work was. And at the end of my dissertation, I was saying, all right, what I believe is what's most valuable of what we accumulate through remote sensing is apps, products that convince people to do climate change with, but actually what's lost in time, what we believe, what we derive as maxwells. First-hand thing. What I believe to be forest here, what he believes to be forest there. Those things were lost. But they didn't realize to keep them. That's what generates our understanding of the big earth. We lost them. If we are going to keep on losing them, that's fine. But for the sake of science, I would say, well, why not let's just accumulate those at that point between different ontologies. So that's my job market paper. If you know an opening, I'll be very glad to do the same presentation.
Very important point.
What types of data did you consider? Was it land use data primarily?
Yeah. My work was on forest cover change.
Forest cover change. So global warming has made sure that you will have jobs.
I didn't advertise myself into that community.
No, I just did mention it happening there, but.
Getting back to what you were saying about dynamically defining the relationship, like you still have to have a population movement.
relationships, and then you have to have some criteria to refine to those things to say that under these conditions, this relationship is this or that. So graphically, you got two bosses, the line between that one that is going to change depending on the data makeup on each side of the room. And it's almost like a graduate scale, where you're dragging a whole line and what was the criteria you applied there to make that happen? It's almost as much an effort as when you were doing it the other way, applying all the rules against the enemy from this relationship.
Right. And I presented some ideas of how you could do that using organic relationship metrics instead of saying that, well, this change from this to this, we have this much of a change instead of this. Mm-hmm. You could essentially, in a relative sense, discern that, oh dear, in this area, a lot of things changed. Right? They are so different in terms of their makeup on all these dimensions. Whereas there are some places that have only this difference. So you can see, look at change in terms of gradedness. The traditional land cover to map overlay is either saying this changed or it didn't. Or it said this changed from this to this, and then the other 100 combinations possible because we have so many classes, which becomes a very problematic exercise because the number of possible from this to this combinations.
You should change and apply depending on what happened, what changed, what something was going to cause to something else. Where before you had 6 attributes to describe that class, now you've got 10 to describe that class because other things were introduced. Is that what you're saying about are you always dealing with that same number of attributes?
No, that number of attributes, right, that number of attributes obviously need to be the same in any one comparison in order to do the comparison. But they're likely to change over time,
right,
as you want to include more or new dimensions, right? And that is a problem that I also think has a solution in the idea that, well, we have to find a solution to it because it will never stop. We will always come up with the next or dimension that is interesting to us. So we'll add that to the mix. And then we'll have to kind of re-engineer. Back in the 90s, when we talked about this class, we never talked about it in this term that we now are interested in. Can we somehow say something because we added in there or map it to that term? And then all of a sudden you bring that old data back into the mix again.
Now, Ola, in the beginning, you talked about these two publications, the last one being 2001, and they were incompatible.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering whether anybody has worked to make them more compatible so that we can sort of have apples and apples and compare the old data to have.
You have,
right? I thought so.
And they've done, USGS has done a change data set, right?
Yeah. I can reprocess the original.
Ah, they upgraded the original. They mapped it to the new classifications.
Yeah, not only the changes in the I'm an expert in this area, but the classification, what were the categories, but also the algorithms used to process the data changed.
Mm-hmm.
That was also part of the device.
Yeah. They returned and reprocessed, as you say, in order to make a change data set out of it. But what I did was, just by means of an experiment, I'm not saying that it was correct, but demonstrating, essentially took those two land cover classes
systems, added the list of attributes, turned out to be 16 different attributes that all got their values for each length of the class, both in the old and the new system. And then, through all class plots, and calculated the similarities and differences between each class, both in the old and the new system. Based on those metrics, you can then produce the grade change now. And say, in terms of this type of relationship, place went 0.2 in change, or they're 0.2 different, or another area 0.8 different, as long as 0 to 1 grade. Right? You can produce this sort of a continuous change map from the original data. The thing I've messed with is trying to formally enrich the category, the class label. And I think, based on my experience with that, it shouldn't be impossible to do that, at least with the types of scientific data that I'm working with. Much more skeptical or not as optimistic about quick progress when it comes to less controlled vocabularies, everyday language.
No, we were. I tried to make a connection to what Dalia had said before about the RDF, and I think that's the one what I was reaching for. Because I think your group took some descriptions and found concepts that you could sort of bring out of those descriptions to be useful. I think it's a little bit of what Ola is talking about here. It's sort of like taking more text descriptions and making it to more metadata. And of course, RDFS is the one step up metadata, formal metadata, formalizable metadata anyway. You sort of work that a little bit, right?
Yeah, at first we looked just on the spatial predicates, but we found a lot of qualitative terms that, indicated, that pointed to scientific processes. In fact, in our ontology, we named properties. One is location, one is description, it's the shape of a bowl. And the third one is generator, which represents the scientific geochemical process, the formation of this entity, whatever it is. And we found that a lot in our descriptions. But in terms of everyday terms, that's harder to classify. So if anything, we just stuck to the standard definitions just to kind of make. But it's absolutely true. I mean, the actual user community is way beyond that.
I must say that as a whole, a number of the presentations, and I was only able to put part of my mind on the presentation without things going on, but I was really encouraged for the NSF work that's going on here that can be leveraged in terms of base stuff and some methodologies and how to do it and some good examples of spatial relations that are sort of broken out and places where people said, well, we need to agree on partonomies or partologies and so forth. I think that actually is, I can imagine that happening because I know a fair amount of work in that area that I think we can leverage. Just leveraging a lot of these things, if you can get enough of people from the relevant parts of the community to sort of spend a little time talking to each other and talking to us, I think we can make some good progress.
The whole point of the project really is to create a
space,
a virtual space, for people to come together to do that, and workshops to help facilitate them.
Nancy, are you still out there? You want to add anything?
I'm still here. I'm just listening.
Okay. Well, you can certainly ask a question if you want. Or make a comment.
Part of what we've done, the way we've approached some of the talk, is through what we call context research. We basically look at basic ontological relationships and search class data, and we said the perspective of the asker really influences what your class hierarchy could look like. It really influences assertions of same as and whatnot. And so the way we try to capture that is through writing swirl rules, where we basically would define a context, and then we would try to write as succinctly as we could swirl rules that would manipulate a very basic ontology and graph structure based on that ontology into a way that makes sense for whatever the perspective is. So the example that we always used was a helicopter landing zone example, where you're calling and you're asking
I need to, where can I land my helicopter? What things can hurt me? So if you're a helicopter, things like an RPG, an observed RPG position, or an anti-aircraft gun, those things can hurt you. Someone with a rifle on the ground, they cannot hurt you. So contrast that to if you had infantry coming in, the RPG and the anti-aircraft can no longer hurt you, but now the rifle can. Now the person on the corner with an IED can hurt you. And so if you just asserted certain things in your hierarchy in a static manner, you couldn't ask the question. You'd either get one or the other. Whereas by writing, in our case, just by writing a few swirl rules, we're able to do that with the data. And we wrote some vocabulary that could intercept a Sparkle query and determine your context, and then execute the swirl rules, then issue the query so that you were getting the data in the way that you wanted it. And that could be a potential way in the land cover example to say, you know, what has changed. Well, if you're really caring specifically details about a forest, just changing the makeup of the forest can make a difference to you, whereas if you have a different perspective, change might only be forest to wetland, to forest to grassland.
Right.
Another
form of sort of aggregation or level of interest. So yes. What's the level of aggregate level? Or what's...
Exactly. We built that research on our mineralogy research that we've done previously. And it works well together. I mean, obviously, the more disjoint and the more complex your context roles are, you can very quickly need so many swirl roles or so many roles to describe it can become intractable. But as long as you can write your ontology, as you were saying, very generally, don't try to assert too many class hierarchy, very flat, almost denormalized, stealing a term from the database world, it makes it much easier to have a few rules come in and build out the structure that you need.
Yeah. And the way I thought about it in terms of these land cover classes is that obviously if I look at different classification systems, they do emphasize different things. Some are more agriculturally oriented and make a lot of distinctions about agricultural practices and things that are important to agriculture, like soil fertility or wetness of the land and things like that. Just general land cover doesn't quite do that as much, but separate a little bit more about the natural conditions where agriculture doesn't mind. It's just non-ag type of things. But by including this long list of characteristics, you can always reweight them and think of them in terms of ratings. These three are the most important, and they get the highest weighting in your comparison.
Mm-hmm.
If I look at it from that perspective, I will look at that weighting for any category out there, and how do they qualify when I just look at these factors? Then all of a sudden, three new things pop out. Is what you're essentially saying is that I'm interested in what can hurt me,
mm-hmm.
because this doesn't hurt me, but
mm-hmm.
this does. And I'm looking at that particular factor. I'm not interested in a lot of other things. So I'm essentially just reweighting my interest, refocusing, and that is pretty easy to do if you have it disorganized. But the recurring problem would be, what are those characteristics? I mean, in my case, I had almost a closed world assumption. I knew what I wanted to match. So I came up with this list of 16 factors, which they were taken from a global attribute list, so it's supposed to be something of a total global set of factors.
So one way I have, of thinking of something you talked about, so you have these list of attributes for some feature you're interested in, and then actually features are related. Then I have sort of, whatever that is, that's several things connected, that features with attributes and so forth. You have external to it, you have a thing, so think of that in parentheses, you have a view, particular view, and that view says the weighting, what the weightings are for the attributes. So that you have this thing sitting there and you apply a view to it. You have a default view, and then something comes up and you have an ag view.
Mm-hmm.
So then you get a different interaction between the elements because the weightings change on the things that are inside the bracket, and the view allows you to sort of then have an output of it saying, okay, so that's really become desert. It's become more of a desert now. It's reclassified this view, or it's a burning village as opposed to sand desert.
And that view gets your idea of what is the
reflect the perspective of the person who's looking at it. The position that they had is the same as your context, presumably.
I agree with you, but each of the classes involves balance in the course, because the reputation is that whatever your evidence is true,
and some of the critiques that are raised with this, there is always going to be someone who says that, well, we need to look at these attributes as well, and then all of a sudden your descriptions won't cut it because they lack these attributes.
One of the challenges of attribute approach of any kind is orthogonality, that is the independence of attributes as opposed to interaction. You may have to define some interaction terms, which, because if there are threshold effects of two attributes and we're above the threshold, then something else happens about it. It isn't linear.
Yeah, the perfect example when you look for is it how much water coverage, how much vegetation coverage, and whatever ionic coverage. They all sum to 100%. Right. So there is this dependence between those three factors, but they're still separate in some sense.
Yeah, on some view.
Right.
Some view, they're independent.
One way we've gotten around the new...
By the way, we are literally at the moment when I know Dahlia needs to make a plane, so I wanted to make sure it's a quarter of three.
Yeah.
We can sort of wrap up in the next 5 minutes.
Once you finish what you're talking.
Yes.
Thank you. One thing that we've done, added, one of the big powers of ontology and knowledge base is the ability to add new attributes down the road after the fact. But then we've had a lot of problems with some of our customers where we then ask questions of the data and they would get inaccurate answers because the question they asked a week ago now has a different answer because it biases the potentially the new data with new attributes. So we've essentially abstracted out a lot of our attributes a meta class where we define the life cycle of that new attribute. So we can have new triples and new assertions.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we come in, one context we use is at what time am I at, what actual time am I asking the query?
Mm-hmm.
So am I asking the query based on literally everything I know at this point, or can I ask the query pretending it's 10 years ago and
right.
get that version of the data and that version mm-hmm. of the answer? And that allows you to still be able to ask 10 years ago queries with new data and get it like, or if you just want absolutely the newest amount of information, you can ask it with today's perspective. That's a relatively straightforward way that you sort of get the best of both worlds. It adds a little bit of overhead.
Mm.
Obviously, at some processing times, there's a few more triples you have to assert, but it allows you to protect your data from a backwards perspective.
And are you capturing those kind of scenarios and time periods? And who those people are asking those questions with ontology, setting up those relationships as well?
We haven't necessarily taken it that level. It's more just sort of an anonymous level where we, in a class or an attribute, we'll have another class, again, sort of a meta class that points to define who defined, well, I guess to an extent then, yes, who defined it, when it was defined, when is that property valid from, and so then you can just do a base query where you don't care about that, or you can come in through that context and say only give me classes and properties and make assertions over classes and properties that were valid in this time.
Well, if it's any value, I think that the work that FAO, that group, and the standards that are developed as ISO standards now, and some of the kind of cross linkages that's been done between different land coverage classification systems could be helpful to that interop.
Yes.
Case study, having some examples to look at. This is what the research community has produced. Can we implement that using some of our technologies or ideas that we've come up with.
Yeah. So I think at least, even if that might move a little bit slowly or whatever, I think we need to have that presented and heard by people as an idea about a way of moving forward. I think one of the ideas for having these workshops is to have people come in saying, here's what I'm doing, here's where I'm going, here's where I think the issues are, the issues I'm handling. This is useful for the following things, we think, and have that discussion. So I think, yes, using some of those things you just talked about would be could be of interest to us.
That community has kind of run it from a very application-oriented perspective, not bothered about too much the ontology.
That's okay. I think we have ontology taking the right role here, which is as a tool.
Right.
As opposed to an end in itself. It's really the tool, and we're showing the tool is a good tool in moving forward, and there's various tools that people are using, bottoms up, top down, some natural language processing.
Multidisciplinary kind of thing, content experts and
applying cognitive
other different kinds of specialists into the dialogue together.
Okay, I think we're supposed to go back, and we don't want to miss some general statements.
So, Nancy, if you're still there, we're going to sign off now, okay?
Okay, thanks.
We are going to be having a happy hour, but I know that you're, you know, it's late for you, so I'll communicate you some of your ideas to the group that you emailed me, and we can talk about that. I'm not sure if we need to call you and bother you later more, but we will hopefully have some ideas for you, okay?
Okay, yeah, thanks for taking good notes.
Okay.
Okay, thanks.
Goodbye.